This is William H. Levy. June 15, 1992. Male and female, he created them. The partner within.
Monday, June 15, 1992. The last of the series of Monday night lectures for this season. William Levy, M.D., speaks this evening of the male and female, he created them. The partner within. This lecture will explore the archetypal feminine and masculine within each of us, as Jung called the anima and the animas.
Yeah, seems to be. Gosh, I haven't been here for a while. It's nice to be here, and I see a lot of faces I know, and that feels good. I'm going to be talking about men and women today, and when I first came here, I needed to use the washroom, and I noticed that we had a washroom across the hall here that was labeled women. And then I went all the way down to the end of the hall where they've remodeled the old washroom. But now it's labeled women / men. So I think that's where we are today. It's kind of hard to talk about this subject of men and women because I'm coming from a place which Jung was coming from. I'm taking a classical position on the animus and the anima, and that basically says that men and women are different, and there's no getting around that one. The position does take one that men and women are different, so that's a kind of a hard talk to give in 1992 here in Seattle, but I still think there are some differences, unless we have some men here who've had babies. Possibly we can develop this a bit. Also, there is a school of thought about, among Jungian analysts in some areas, where they want to do away with the concept of the animus and the anima as separate archetypes and treat them as ego complexes. Just aspects of the ego. Oh, we're getting a little loud here. Is that a sore point? I have a lot of trouble with that one because it robs Jungian psychology of everything transpersonal, as far as I can tell. And I hold these transpersonal aspects of Jungian psychology in very, very high regard. So, from the outset, I'm taking a classical position. Men and women are different, and the anima and the animus are still useful concepts to me and really exist. They're more than just concepts. So with that, I'd like to begin with a text. The text I'm going to begin with is fairly authoritative. It's called the Torah, which is the first five books of the Old Testament. And I'm going to begin with Genesis. Genesis chapter 1, the end of 20, the beginning of 24. And there was evening. This is the one where it starts, in the beginning God created heaven and earth, and then he makes the sun and the moon and separates the land from the firmament and all that stuff. And I'm going to start here at the fifth day. There was evening and there was morning, a fifth day. And God said, let the earth bring forth every kind of living creature, cattle, creeping things, and wild beasts of every kind. And it was so. God made wild beasts of every kind and cattle of every kind and all kinds of creeping things of the earth. And God saw that this was good. And God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness. They shall rule the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, the cattle, the whole earth, and all of the creeping things that creep on the earth. And God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created him. He created them. God said to them, God blessed them and said to them, be fertile and increase, fill the earth and master it, etc. That was the fifth day, and at the end of it, God saw that all that he had made and found it very good. All the others are good, but this day he found very good. And there was evening and morning in the sixth day. And the sixth day was largely a touch-up day. So there we have it, male and female. You know, there's a later story here where the woman is made out of the rib of the man, as if she was a lesser creature. But in this section, woman and man are equal, both created out of the image of God. I hold very, very strongly to that position, that men and women are equal, and both have God in them. Now, it gets a little bit interesting when you know Hebrew, because I also have here the Hebrew text. I just read you the English. This book was originally written in Hebrew around 700 B.C. during the Babylonian captivity. And they took all of the stories of the Jewish people, which were handed down by word of mouth, and they made a book out of them. And some of the stories are very old, and you can tell by the language, and some are very new. This particular story is a fairly new story. It was written around 700 B.C. And the language here is interesting. If you know Hebrew, probably not many of you do, it's based on three-letter word roots. All the Hebrew words, the basic words, have only three letters, and they hang on beginnings and endings to change the case and the tense. Prepositions are beginnings. But basically, every word is like three letters. And this gives you a lot of range of meaning, because you can look at the word, look a word up in a Hebrew dictionary and see what it means, and then see what the words near it that are made out of the same letters mean, because it's really the same roots. Now, for instance, and this is useful in English too, you can take a word and look up its ancient meaning, its etymology, like the word good. If you look that up in the dictionary, it comes from an Indo-European root, gut, which means to fit in. You see? So you can get some meaning out of looking up the etymology of words, but when you look up the etymology of ancient words, you get even more meaning, because you're going back further. So the word, the Hebrew word here for man, for male, God created in the image of God, male and female he created them, is zachar. It's a Hebrew Z, a Hebrew CH, and a Hebrew R. They don't put any vowels in Hebrew. Okay, so it's zachar, man. I may not have that pronounced exactly correctly, but those are the letters. Now, what does that word mean? Well, it means male. But it also has a root word. It means to remember. It means memory. It means right, as in the right to do something or the privilege. Those are all contained in the word male. To remember, to have rights, to have privileges, a memory, male. The word for female here is nakaba. Nakaba, female, is its original main meaning, but it also means assembled, grouped, buried, and perforated. Buried, like under the ground, in the earth. So that's your female in Hebrew. Now, Jung talks about how the male has the logos principle, the masculine has the logos principle. Not the male, not men here. I'm not talking about men and women here. Let me make this clear. We'll talk about men and women later. We're talking about the male and the female, the masculine, the archetypal masculine the archetypal feminine, you know? It's just like there's the archetypal soldier, and you can talk about the characteristics that the archetypal soldier has. He's strong, he's brave, he follows orders, he's obedient, he's clean and neat, you know. You can make a whole list of characteristics of an ideal soldier. That doesn't mean all soldiers are going to be that way. That's just the archetype soldier. And so we can talk about the archetypal masculine. We can also talk about the archetypal feminine. Jung talks about the Eros principle in the archetypal feminine, the connecting principle. Eros is that little guy with the bow and arrow that goes around and shoots people and they fall in love, right? Helps you to connect, Eros. And connecting is a part of the feminine. And even in the word, as back as thousands of years ago when the Hebrew language was put together, they had the idea of the feminine having to do with gathering, having to do with groups, with coming together. Okay. The logos separates, discerns, it's logical. But it's more this idea of analyzing, discerning, breaking up into its parts as a part of the masculine. So that the feminine brings things together. The masculine separates things apart. It's important concepts to have in mind. Now the Chinese in the Tao and in the I Ching, they talk about the trigram for heaven being masculine and the doubling of that trigram into the hexagram, the creative, the double masculine. And they speak of how the essence of this hexagram is duration, that creates time, that the masculine makes time. Now that fits right in with the Hebrew idea of the masculine having memory, because memory allows for linear time. If there was no memory, the concept of linear time would have very little meaning. Can everyone hear me all right? So linear time is a part of the masculine. The Chinese have the trigram for the earth being all yin lines, all open. And the when that's doubled, you have the hexagram for the receptive, the earth. And this is conceptualized by the Chinese as earth, feminine, and as space. So the masculine and the feminine are basically time and space. Years and years ago, I was in a altered state of consciousness, which is a polite way of saying I was nuts. and friends of mine were babysitting me. And one friend of mine was Bruce. And Bruce was a walking embodiment of Christ. That he just carried himself saintly, good, and gentle, wonderful, and that was what he breathed. So in his presence, there was no room for any goodness in me. In my state of mind, I was pure evil. I was Satan. And then Bruce left with some relief, because I really didn't like being Satan. And Marty came over. Now, Marty is probably the smartest man I've ever known in my life. If he had been Catholic, he would have been a Jesuit. This guy was in a mind like a steel trap. And so when Marty was there, I started working puzzles in my mind. And I decided to try and figure out, using logic, something which I'm not very good at, actually, trying to figure out what the most basic fact of the universe was. And I thought about it and thought about it, and through a chain of logical deduction that I can't duplicate anymore, I came up with that the basic fact of the universe was the division of things between the masculine and the feminine, between the yin and the yang, feminine and masculine. I think I was right, but the Chinese were way ahead of me on that one by several thousand years. Okay, so we've got these masculine, feminine. I wonder if I could ask you to indulge me for just a few minutes, and if we could kind of, just to get us all singing the same song together, list some of the different characteristics of that which would archetypally fit with the masculine and that which would archetypally fit with the feminine. Let's do the feminine first. What would be some of the characteristics of the feminine? Anyone? Receptive, yes. Nurturing, uh-huh. Emotional, uh-huh. Patient. I can't hear. Intuitive. Gentle. More. Insensitive? Sensitive. Sensitive. Yes. Connected. Yes. Life-giving. Huh? Irrational. Okay. How about the masculine? Huh? Strength. Yeah. Analytical. Huh? Logical. Aggressive. Hierarchical. I think that works for both. Tactile. Hey, can you talk? Say a few more about that, because it seems like both the masculine and the feminine touch. Yeah. But maybe there's more of a pushing quality. Reaching for, moving around, getting it. Yeah. Moving around stuff. Yeah. Okay. Spatial? Uh-huh. Aggressive. Yeah. I guess if it was going to be like plants and animals, the masculine would be more like the animal and the feminine would be more vegetative. Uh-huh. I think so. Okay. Now, I handed out something called a Jungian glossary. Everyone get one of these? If you don't have one, I got more, and you can look over someone's shoulder. Actually, Mark's got some. Anyone else need any? Can you pass a few over there to that end, Mark? Okay. Yes.
Those athletes were collected outside of Europe.
Right.
Was Jung propose those distinctions, male or female, or is that just our prejudice?
Well, Jung wouldn't disagree with anything that I've heard. There are places where he talks about this. And divides up these different characteristics. So, but, you know, these are, the idea of what is masculine and what is feminine has been around in the culture for thousands and thousands of years. Most Romance languages have gender endings for each word. And objects like ships are thought of as feminine, and objects like... Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, we will. But no, Jung does say that these are characteristics of the masculine and of the feminine. And whether they're cultural or biological, we're going to get into that. Okay? I want to do some definitions now. I want to start with anima, the feminine aspect of the archetypal male-female duality, and animus, the masculine aspect of the archetypal male-female duality. So the animus and the anima are archetypes. Before we go any further, we need a definition of archetypes, right? I happen to have one. This is a good one. Archetype. an intrapsychic, autonomous, a priori ordering principle of the human psyche. Okay, intrapsychic. It's in here. You're not going to run into it on the dark alley or anything. It's in the mind. It's autonomous. Autonomous. What an interesting word, autonomous. What does that mean? If we break it down linguistically, autonomous means auto, self, nomen, name. An autonomous being is a being that names itself. What a grand concept. It sort of has it all contained in it, in terms of what this autonomous means. It's really in the word. And an archetype is autonomous. We do not give orders to archetypes. Archetypes do what they jolly well please. And this is true of the animus and the anima as well. These are, if you get nothing else from this talk, get this. The animus and the anima, as conceptualized by Jung, are not accessories to our ego. An animus is not a sort of a masculine helper that helps you out whenever you need a job done that's sort of a masculine job. An animus does what he jolly well pleases. He's bigger than you are. An anima does what she jolly well pleases. They're autonomous, self-naming. We do not name them. They may have names. We might even be able to find out their names, each of our own individual animuses and animas. But we're not going to name them. They name themselves. Autonomous. Okay. It's an intrapsychic, autonomous a priori. What does that mean? A priori. Before. Without experience. You don't, it doesn't, it's just there. You're born with these things. It doesn't come to you because your mother beat you up when you were little. They're inside you at birth, a priori. Okay. Like an instinct to mother, to do mothering. You're born with that. You're not taught it. Ordering principle of the human psyche. Okay, that's what an archetype is. The anima and the animus are archetypes. Question? I want to get this before we go on. Yes? It's a system to run the world in case your ego isn't paying attention. It's like for instance, when a woman gives birth to a baby, she has a natural mother archetype which makes her feel wonderful when she's with her baby and not so good when she's not with her baby. And so she's going to want to be with the baby a lot. And it's kind of a natural, whether she likes it or not, she's going to do it because the archetype gives her this really good feeling. You see, so it keeps the world humming and keeps babies getting taken care of. Yes. Some seem to have the qualities of personality. The ancients called the archetypes gods. The Greek gods on Mount Olympus was just another word for archetypes. They were different principles. Yes. I would imagine so. I mean, nothing happens in our bodies that doesn't have a chemical aspect to it. You know, falling in love is an archetype phenomenon, and there's certainly chemical changes that happen when a person falls in love. You can certainly get hormonal changes, and I think you have a higher level of some of those ecstasy generated feelings, carriers with when women are with their babies nursing. Yeah, sure. Yes. Oh, probably. I wouldn't pretend to know them all. You know, Jung named half a dozen big ones and sort of stopped. I would imagine it's not infinite. Yes. Since it really is biological, you know, it's a biological substrate. What we're talking about here is the servo mechanisms that keep human beings functioning and doing what's necessary for the survival of the race. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about archetypes, really. For the most part. Okay, so let's get back to our definition now of anima and animus. Anima, the feminine aspect of the archetypal male-female duality, whose projections in the external world can be traced through myth, philosophy, and religious doctrine. That's a quote from Jung, Archetypes in the Collective Unconscious. I go on to give an explanation. This is an autonomous, a priori woman, quote, contained within the psyche of every man. She manifests herself whenever man finds himself in a situation which calls forth the feminine within him. Her primary function in the ideal ego is to function as a bridge between the ego and the objective psyche or collective unconscious. That's a mouthful. That's a mouthful. But that's really true. I think it's really got it. It's a reasonably good definition here. We'll talk more about that. The one about the animus says exactly the same thing, except that we switch around the words a little bit. The masculine aspect of the archetypal male-female duality, whose projections in the external world can be traced through myth, philosophy, and religious doctrine. This is an autonomous a priori man contained within the psyche of every woman. He manifests himself whenever the woman finds herself in a situation which calls forth the masculine within her. His primary function in the ideal psyche is to function as a bridge between the ego and the objective psyche or collective unconscious. So it's the same thing, but in women, it's a guy on the inside and a woman on the outside, and in guys, it's a woman on the inside and a man on the outside. And you just kind of reverse it. There are some little differences here. The one thing I didn't put in the definition of animus is I said it was a man. That isn't really true. It's a committee. It's a group of men. And it's one woman in a man, but she has a large wardrobe. And can wear all kinds of costumes. Huh? Okay. Now, how do they function? Well, basically, you see the animus and the anima functioning in three ways. They can function in inflation, where you get all caught up in them. They can function in projection, where you project the animus or the anima on someone else. And they can function just within the psyche, doing their job of connecting you to the deeper psyche. I'm going to start with inflation. I'll start, and I'm quoting this now from, this comes from The Symbolic Quest by Whitmott, which I think is still available in print. Identity with the anima in a man, that's inflation, anima inflation, manifests itself in all sorts of compulsive moodiness, self-pity, sentimentality, depression, brooding, withdrawal, fits of passion, morbid oversensitivity, or effeminacy. Namely, in emotional and behavior patterns that cause a man to act like an inferior or exaggerated woman. Sort of like Betty Davis, you know, or something. How can you talk to me that way? You've all seen this. You've all seen it. That's the anima in inflation. This is where the anima, the archetype, this woman who lives inside the man, has taken over control, is pulling the strings, and the man is a puppet responding to this woman who's pulling his strings in relationship. Usually when you see a man who's inflated with an anima, there's a woman who's inflated with animus who's not very far away. And usually you see the two doing this horrible dance, which... What, want me to repeat the list? Uh-huh. The anima manifests itself in a sort of compulsive moodiness, self-pity, sentimentality, depression, brooding, withdrawal, fits of passion, morbid oversensitivity, or effeminacy. Or any combination of the above. Any or all. Okay. Just as the man in an anima inflated state is moody, undependable, and withdrawn, the animus-ridden woman is ruled by preconceived notions, prejudices, and expectations, is dogmatic, argumentative, and overgeneralizing. An animus-possessed woman argues not to discover truth, but in order to be right, to win, and have the last word. So it's sort of like, oh, you've wounded me, and I'm going to wound you again if you don't shut up. Yeah. Have you all seen these kind of fights? I mean, it's so common, it's so ubiquitous that I've never heard of a couple that didn't experience this sometime or another, you know. Yeah. Very, very common. Someone says, well, what about homosexual men and women? Well, I don't think it makes any difference. I think it's exactly the same thing. I think the homosexual woman who is animus inflated will be argumentative, dogmatic, all those things, and the homosexual man who is anima inflated will be moody, petulant, all those things. But it doesn't make any difference at all. Any questions about the state of inflation? This is a state where the ego is identified with the archetype and taken over by it. When a man and a woman are having an animus-anima battle, nobody is home. The archetypes are running the show. And let me just finish my point. I remember once when I was very wounded by my wife, Trudy, and I realized, I felt my anima rising up in me, and I was going to throw a fit. And I said to myself, but wait a minute, I'm really not that wounded. This really doesn't bother me that much. It's not such a big deal. I don't want to throw a fit. Oh, yes, you're going to throw a fit, comes inside. Look what she said to you. How could you know, it's very hard to resist this. Very, very hard to resist this. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah. What causes it? It's in the nature of the archetypes to be inflated sometimes with them. The archetype wants to take over and run things. And it'll sneak out at every chance it gets to do it. Now, some people tend to be more likely to fall into this than other people. It's like some animas, their job is to connect you to the unconscious, but they don't do that. You know, it's like, I don't do windows. Moi, windows, never, you know. And I don't connect you to the unconscious, but I'll help you fight if you want. You know, I'm going to make you moody, that I can do. You know, you get that. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Immediately, automatic reaction, the man comes in a bad mood, maybe from work. You know, nothing to do with his wife. He walks in feeling bad, immediately out comes the sword, and you start getting the rapier effect of the animus with a barrage of... You know that one, right? Yeah, yeah. And it's very verbal. Generally, the animus attacks are very verbal, very specific, very precise, lots of logos, clear language, you know. Yeah.
I gather the rules are you can't support
the... That's right. Well, you can try, but I don't know of a court. It's a question of jurisdiction.
If it was great to the unconscious, then it insists on inflating and embarrassing you all the time. You can't fire it. You can't support it.
You can fight it. You can try not to do that. It can grow. Huh? Well, I think analysis can help with that. I really do. The best cure for an overly active, overly controlling animus or anima is to fall in love with someone or something. That's the best cure for it. And that takes us to the next question here. The anima and the animus in projection. Now, you all know about projection when we talk about the shadow in projection. Here, that's a projection of your bad traits or the things you don't like about yourself onto someone else, so you get mad at the someone else, like you may have guessed I like to eat. And, you know, if there's a pie that has to be divided and you want the bigger piece, you're going to have an angry person, namely me, because how can you be so greedy as to take the bigger piece, right? Because I want the bigger piece. You know, there's that shadow projection stuff that you're all pretty used to, I think. Anima-animus projection is completely different and nothing like that at all. When you project the anima and the animus on another person, you fall in love with that person. That's what happens with anima-animus projection. There's no other possibility. When you project the anima or the animus onto a thing, onto an object, like I love sailing, and so I project my anima on my boat. She's come to me in dreams as a boat. And I'm fascinated. You know, I can walk into a boat store and just spend hours walking around in that store looking at the pumps and things I have absolutely no need for at all. But they're fascinating. And, you know, if I did have a need for it, I would have bought it months ago. That's an anima projection. I'm kind of in love with boats and boat things. Okay. But it's not as consuming in that I'm dealing with an inanimate object and there's no no in-love back. It's not as consuming as an actual in-love experience with a person where you have an anima, animus projection. Now, that's true. I don't know. Which is more expensive, the boat or the woman? I've never run into that kind of woman. But that's true. No boat will. That's true. Okay. That's true. Then you need a fishing license and you got to do all that work. Yeah. The anima, animus in projection. What we have here then is love. That's falling in love. Now see, this sort of gets at why I consider this so important. Because when you fall in love, has just about everyone in here been in love at one time or another? A couple minutes maybe? Yeah. When you're in love, the world becomes a magical place. You don't have to worry about where to go, because wherever you go, you're going to raise the tone of the whole place. It will become magical because you're there when you're in love. Everything is magical. You're like a god and goddess walking on the earth. And you feel that way too. And you feel complete. And time is divided into two kinds of time. Good time, when you're with the person you're in love with, and bad time, when you're not with the person you're in love with. And it's just that simple. Everything becomes simple, but very, very magical. Always magical, always special, always this feeling of union, this feeling of knowing what's going on in another person. This magic is archetypal. This is very special, very precious. This is one of God's great gifts to us. And to say, to throw this away, I think, is craziness. To say that these archetypes that are responsible for this feeling don't exist, or that it's a disease of some kind. Pardon?
Brain herpes,
right, right. That's a real shame, to my way of thinking, because this is a magic doorway into the unconscious, into the archetypal world. It's like taking mind-altering drugs without any drugs, you know? You can see things that you didn't even know existed. Your heart can be opened. Very, very important. It's a spiritual thing. And that's why I say this is like the doorway to the transpersonal. Because if it can open your heart so that you can feel these things that love is all about, then this archetype, this anima, this animus, can also show you your own inner magic that's within your own psyche, that's available to you, and can lead you to the self and to God. And that's why I think it's so important. That's my pitch. okay. Yes? Is thwarted, where the love isn't worked. Horrible feeling. Most people will not allow themselves to get into that situation. When you're thinking about loving someone, you know, you start to fall in love with someone, you feel it happening, the first thing you're checking is, do they love me too? You know? No, they don't. They can't, you know? And then how wonderful it feels when you find out they do. Huh? Yeah. But if they don't, usually doesn't go very far. Okay. Love transcends time. There's a wonderful little poem, something about how for those who are in joy, time is swift. For those who wait, time is slow. But for those who love, time is not. I like that. Well, yeah, see, that's the thing. You're really in love with yourself because you're projecting the animus out or the anima out. That's what the guys who want to convince you that this is a disease will try and sell you. But you see, the thing is that there's a tendency to be drawn and attracted to a type of person that fits your animus or anima. And when that's a mutual fit, when the person, when you're young, you fall in love with whoever's there, and you know, but when the person that you fall in love with who loves you back is really like your anima, and you're like their animus in reality, I mean, it's not going to be perfect ever, but, you know, we're kind of like in the ballpark there, you know. Then you have what's called true love. And that's a neat thing. Yeah. Yeah. 90% of the people who come to see me because of such a disappointment. Yes, that frequently the projection doesn't work. It doesn't take. You're falling in love with somebody who really is wrong for you, or someone's falling in love with you that you don't want, you know, and that's very upsetting, that's very hurting, that's a lot of pain. A lot of times you're doing a lot of shopping trying to find this. But everybody wants it, I think. I think that's what we're all looking for. It's darn hard to find. Yeah. Questions? Yeah. Yeah, all those. Yes. Lots of people are. I noticed that, and other people like me story steps. But it can happen. And sometimes it can happen for just a while. But that's good too. Okay? And well, it feels like it's forever though when you're in it, because time is not. And the truth is that sometimes it really can work. Sometimes it can work. It really can happen. I'm a romantic, I guess. But in any case, it certainly is something that everyone wants, and we can agree on the mechanism. We can agree that it's an animus projection. We can agree that it's better when it's mutual. And that it's even still better when the projections have some semblance to the reality. Because, you know, you can be loved just by being quiet and not letting people know who you are, and maybe they'll love you for a while, but sooner or later you're going to expose who you are, and then it can get to be problematical. Yes. Thank you. Yeah, I think it is. I think that would be an animus projection similar to my projection of anima on my boat. Where it really fascinates you and you're really excited about it and you want to do it. It's like you've grown in a few years, you've suddenly become something in your chosen field. And yeah, that's an anima. That's like projecting it on an inanimate object. Absolutely. Oh, wait. You're saying, it doesn't seem possible that a person can provide those needs. Never did I say a word about any need providing. Not a nickel, nothing. Just love. Just love. That's all we're talking about. You know, and you've tipped your hand. Yes. No. He neither said that nor did it. I've read everything he's written that I've been able to find. And does anyone else recall anything like that from Jung? Maybe. Or, yeah. No. What was it you were? Say it again. That you. Or she attributed a statement like that to me. Yeah, well, he didn't marry his anima. Yeah. I'm sort of like, watch out for psychopaths. And, yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, no, I don't know. The projection thing, that's falling in love. There's no other kind of projection except falling in love or being fascinated by or being really fulfilled with, like the work example. These are the projections of animus and anima. Yes, sir. That's a good point. I'm glad you raised that because. Yeah, that's right. The animus and anima, I didn't bother doing the linguistics of animus and anima. Do you know what the words mean?
Soul.
It's the Greek word for soul. But what does it mean? If you go further beyond that.
Hot and cold blowing winds.
Hot and cold blowing winds. That's right. And it also means to make alive, as in the word to animate.
Breath of life.
Breath of life. That's right. So to animate is to make alive. And that's what happens when you fall in love. You feel alive. That more than anything else. With this anima and this animus, you become alive. It gives life meaning. When you put your, like when I go on my boat, I feel more alive than any other activity I can do. And probably the lady in the pink back there feels alive when she's at her work. Yeah. If you really feel, that's time when you're alive. Because the anima, to animate, is to give life to something. An animated picture takes just pictures and makes them move. It makes them alive. Yes, sir?
It seems like
look at the women you're attracted to. That's your anima.
How do I attribute that particular life?
By looking at, by attribute you mean define, picture, see what they're like? Is that what you're asking? Get to know better? When you say attribute, is that what you mean? Well, if you simply look at all of the women you've ever been in love with and kind of make a composite picture. Right, and I still don't hear your question there. It's true. We each of us have separate.
I don't think in my case that I was just born with a particular starter set.
Oh, yeah.
These are the attributes I'm going to be.
Yes, that's the point. Yes, you are born with a starter set, according to Jungian psychology. I remember when I was a very young and in grammar school. I'm talking like second grade. There was a little girl in my grammar school class that I just thought was the greatest thing there ever was. I mean, she was really something special, you know? Of course, I was much too embarrassed to ever speak to her, and in all the years of grammar school, I never did speak to her. Come to find out, my mother, bless her soul, she's something like 83 now, and she was telling me that she was talking to this girl's mother. Now this girl was a grown woman, and the mother asked her that this girl had asked her mother to ask my mother how I was, because she's had a crush on me since grammar school. Isn't that cute? Yeah. I mean, it's a starter set. It's built in. It's built in. It's yeah. Von Franz wrote that one. Von Franz wrote that one. It seems to take on some coloration from the parents, but it's real hard to know. From a Jungian perspective, the archetype comes first, and the parents just get into the act. It really is. From the Jungian perspective, it's a starter kit. You're born with it. Yes. Qualities that attract. I'm Jewish. Qualities that attract me in a woman are going to be very similar to qualities in my mother. There's no question about that. But I still see myself as having been born with that package, you know? And maybe some of the flavor of it, the kind of wardrobe she has in her closet, can come from the mother. The kind of perfume she's going to wear, you know? The kind of clothes she wears, the that sort of thing could come from the mother. But the basic internal nature, that's a given. My anima has some witchy qualities about her. I know that. And my mother does not. She really doesn't. And this came in the package deal that came, you know, before I was born, really. That's the Jungian concept of it anyway. Yes, sir? Split anima. I don't know any other kind myself. He didn't know any other kind either. Yeah. I think it would be really neat to have an anima that kind of all flowed together in one piece and didn't look like a couple of different people. But I don't know what that experience would be like personally. I know of people who do. Some of my patients are lucky enough to have this. It would be a great anxiety reliever. It would make it possible to have the friend and lover be in one person. Boy, that would be nice, you know. Yes. Yeah, where he would have the split, where his wife carried one aspect of it and Tony Wolf another, yeah. But it's like trying to... Pardon? One tries to do that in terms of my own anima and its wholeness. It just recently started working at all. You know, I'm very grateful for that. Wholeness is more than I would even ask for myself. But that's a very complex and a deep question. I wonder if we could get into that perhaps a little later on. But it's a good question. Yes. Yes, sir.
I want to press my question from what I understand so far, which is what you're saying is acts like a hereditary sort of instinctual thing perhaps passed on genetically.
Exactly.
So, do you see similarities that have been studied from each of our families as far as how some of the archetypes work?
Object choices? Yeah, there haven't been any real studies done about this kind of stuff. It's kind of a little bit on the woo-woo side, you know, and it doesn't really attract hardcore scientists to do a statistical analysis and calculate a T. It's a good question, but it's in that area where it's pretty fluid and hard to evaluate, you know, and I think it'd be really tough to design a study that way, you know, like what kind of women are identical twins attracted to, kind of thing.
Right, but if you had a brother, and you'd say a large portion of the women you see, the women would be your lover,
yeah, it'd be a chance of it. It'd be interesting. One could do that. One could look at the lover choices of identical twins and see what you get. Yeah, that could be done. I'm not sure how to measure it exactly, but it could be done. I want to... My bladder's telling me we're going to need a break pretty soon. And I wanted to cover, at least before everybody escapes, out. They mention it, but they never tell you what it means. And that is that the animus and the anima are supposed to be a buffer between the ego and the collective unconscious. And everybody agrees that that's true. even the ones who don't believe in the anima and the animus as autonomous will say that the name of that ego complex that buffers the unconscious with the ego is the animus and the anima. That there's general agreement about. But what in the world does that mean, buffering or going between the ego and the collective unconscious? Sounds like a nice idea. It's a great word. I can say it. You could say it back. It's good on tests. But what does it really mean? I came up with a metaphor for it, which I think more clearly explains it than anything else I've run into. It came along with my own getting a little bit of development of anima and finding her doing some of the work of buffering my ego, buffering some of the unconscious pressures that impinge upon my ego. And the model is this. I've got a device I recently got for my boat. It's called an auto helm. And it is an extremely useful device. Normally, when you're sailing a boat, and my boat's a sailboat, you have to be at the steering wheel, at the wheel, at all times, because a wave comes and kicks it one way, another wave comes and kicks it another way, the current comes and kicks it still a third way, and you're constantly working, fighting the ocean and all of its currents to keep your boat going in a relatively straight line. If you just left the wheel dangle, the boat would go around in circles until it reached the nearest rock. As a sailor, without any devices, you are chained to your wheel. You or somebody else has to be standing at that wheel at all times on the boat, just to deal with the ocean or the sound. Now, they make a device called an autopilot or auto helm. And what that device is, it's a small compass with a motor attached to it. And so if I'm steering, say, a due north course, and I push the button and turn on this device, then it will hold a due north course. And if a wave kicks the boat to the south, it'll turn the wheel, it'll know it's gone to the south because the compass will read a little bit more south. So it'll turn the boat a little bit around so that it's back to a due north course again. Keeps the boat going on the course that you set it. Now, if you set it pointing at a rock, it'll sail you right into that rock. Well, you don't want to do that. But you can set your course with this device, and it will adjust the helm for you to adjust for the waves. In fact, it's even so clever. Sometimes, you know, the things that knock you off course are waves. And the waves keep coming at a regular, repetitive rate over and over again the same way. So in order to conserve energy, it has a little computer in it to tell whether or not it's been knocked off course in this particular way before. And if it discovers it has, then it doesn't bother correcting for that one. So it's a very clever device which buffers your boat from the ocean so that you can walk around and adjust your sails and go to the bathroom and cook a meal or kind of like do whatever you've got to do. Just kind of relax, but keep your eyes open, you know. And it takes care of dealing with the water, with the ocean, with the currents, with the waves for you. Well, that's what the anima and the animus do when they're working. They buffer the ego. They buffer between the unconscious of the ocean and the ego to leave the ego free to do other tasks without having to stand there worrying about what kind of monster's coming up from the unconscious today to deal with. That's the function of a working anima. It's a wonderful device to have on a boat, and it's a wonderful device to have in life too. And in fact, the Greeks thought so highly of it that the basis of the Eleusinian mysteries was helping people essentially to get functioning animas and animuses so that then people could just kind of relax and go about their business. And all of our Western civilization is based on that principle. On this point, I think we'll take a intermission. Someone asked about homosexual love. And I don't see why that would be a problem. It seems to me that it would work in exactly the same way. This is different than classical Jung, however. Classical Jung felt that a homosexual person was hopelessly lost in anima for a woman, for a man, or animus for a woman, inflation. That they were just controlled by the woman inside or the man inside. That has not been my experience with the homosexual people I've known and worked with. I don't see why a man can't project his anima on a man and fall in love with a man. If I can project it on a boat, why can't he project it on a man, you know? If that's the kind of anima it is. And I don't know why that can't be mutual. And I don't know why a woman can't project her animus on a woman and fall in love with a woman. So I don't see any problem or conflict there. To me, it's just a natural thing. Now, we've talked about how the animus and anima function in inflation, how they function in projection, and some about how they function normally. The question comes, how do they function in active imagination and in dreams? In dreams, the anima usually comes to a man in the form of women. In general, when a man has a dream of a woman who he finds somewhat attractive, or potentially attractive in some way, or interesting, that's usually a symbol of the anima. And in a woman, it comes as men. It's a little confusing if they're older men or older women, because then it could be the father archetype or the mother archetype. But generally, the anima comes as a contrasexual person. The anima and the animus come as contrasexual person. And in homosexuals, they do too, usually. Well, let's see, the question is, what if you dream of a male person that was not kind to you? Or that you weren't attracted to? Okay, it still can be animus, because the woman's animus, frequently you get dreams, women dream of the intruder in the night, the intruder coming to do God knows what to them. And that is usually a dream of the animus. Yeah. The animus is not always so attractive. Generally, I feel good when the animus is human in dreams. The Godzilla coming at night causes me problems. And you see that as things mature, as things grow in analysis, you see the images change from Godzilla to a maniac, to a killer, to a thief, to a gangster, to maybe a friendly, organized crime mafia-type gangster. It gets more and more human as you go through these maturational levels, as the animus changes. But initially, it starts out as a very frightening figure. Generally, the animus in a woman's dreams is an invader trying to get into her house, have access to her. It's dangerous, it's hurtful. The fear of the masculine seems to be a built-in. Yeah. Okay. I want to give you an idea of what this animus is like. And I ran into this some years ago. I give a course in my home to people who are interested where we just read lecture notes from Jungian lectures that Jung himself gave years and years ago, like in the 30s. And we go over those and discuss them, and I read them aloud. Sometimes we even get a few sentences in during a class. And one of the books we used was this book called The Vision Seminars. And this is This is a series of visions that this one woman had. She was a patient of Jung's, and he tells you her visions, and then he analyzes them. And there's very little written in the Jungian literature about the animus. You can read about the anima yourself, but the animus is hard to find, and this book is out of print. So I thought I would share this with you. Here's the vision that this patient had, who's doing active imagination. That is, she just has this vision at night, and she reports it to Jung. She's awake when she has it, but in kind of a dream state, and she's seriously moved by this active imagination. I beheld a face with the eyes closed. I besought the face, open your eyes, look into my eyes that I may behold them. Then the face became very dark, and slowly I beheld what no man is meant to see, eyes full of beauty and woe and light, and I could bear it no longer. And she drew a picture of this face, and she showed it to Jung, and it's a picture of an animal with these eyes. This sadness, this dark, sad eyes full of beauty and woe, like Beauty and the Beast, like the Beast in Beauty and the Beast, that sense. And if you've ever really looked into the eyes of an animal, you can kind of get what she's talking about here. And this is, in my mind, ultimately, what the animus is at core. It's an animal. It's the inner animal in the woman. And it has that sadness that the animal has without the consciousness, without all the connectedness that women understand. You know, the ancients talked about the women as all being connected together, the groups. The word even means community. And it's true. Women do have this sense of connectedness that guys aren't into. And that is one of the differences. But I wanted to share with you this vision of the animus. Now, I'll read you what Jung has said here. I think it's important. This is the first vision where she is positively stung. Up till now, she has been sightseeing. But here, it gets under her skin. This vision has really moved her. How do we know that? First of all, she uses biblical language, old-fashioned language. You know, when you're doing active imagination, some people think of that as just kind of sitting in your drawing room and having a chat with some inner beings. And that isn't what Jung meant at all. When Jung speaks of active imagination, he speaks of it as a confrontation. But in German, it comes out much better, because the confrontation, the word for which is translated in English as confrontation, is Aus- und Unterseitzung, which has an image of out and under and beside and between. It's like you're battling all over the house. That's an active imagination. An active imagination is where you're starting to go a little bit crazy and you're having hallucinations. And, you know, you willed yourself to do this and now you're doing it and now they're coming and you can't control them so much. They kind of are autonomous and they do what they're doing. That's active imagination. And that's what he's saying happened to this woman. You can tell whether you're doing active imagination or not because the language starts to get to be archaic. if you're really in touch with archetypes. You tend to get this old-fashioned language, and here she's kind of into this old-fashioned language. Where she says, "I besought the face, open your eyes, look into my eyes, that I may behold them." This is a tough lady here. This is not someone who normally talks this way. It's a modern lady. This is the first vision where she's positively stung. Up till now, she's been sightseeing, but here it gets under her skin. I will show you a picture she made. It is an animal, a dark, hairy face with the melancholy eye of the animal. You see, what really happened was that they traveled back, and not only to ancient Greece, but further. The animal's letter, he's talking about previous visions, led her inevitably back to the animal age. That is, you remember, the purpose of the Dionysian or Eleusinian mysteries, to bring people back to the animal, not to what we know as the animal, not that they should identify with it as we understand it, but to the animal within you. This vision was really, as it were, the bottom. She looked directly into the eyes of the animal, and they are full of woe and beauty, for they contain the truth of life, an equal sum of pain and pleasure, the capacity for joy, the capacity for suffering. Therefore, the eye is very bewildering, as the eye of the primitive is very bewildering. The eye of the primitive and the unconscious man and the eye of the animal have the same peculiar expression of that mental state before consciousness, which is neither pain nor pleasure. One doesn't know exactly what it is. It's both. She looks here into the very soul of the animal, and that is the experience she should have. Otherwise, she is disconnected from nature. And actually, what she needed to do was to really get in touch with her deeper nature like that. And in this instance, she does. It's a very powerful image. And it moved me greatly, and it had got me to realize what the animus is really all about. And it's all about the animal. There was a wonderful movie called The Women. It's all women, and it shows their lives and their interrelations. But the beginning of it, for the titles, it shows a little animal, and then it closes up into that animal, and then there's a woman there. And then it shows a different animal, and it closes up into that animal, and then there's a woman there. And it lays out all the characters, all the women in that way, showing you first the animal inside the women. And as you come to know the women through the movie, you can see the animal inside them. You know, I forget. Thank you. It's an older movie in the 30s or 40s. Yeah. And absolutely marvelous. A highly black and white, but I highly recommend it. Yeah. Yes? Well, sure. What's the difference? I don't think you can actually damage the anima or the animus. They're immortal. They're gods and goddesses. You can damage your interface with them. Yeah. So you can't relate to them or get a hold of them. Yeah. Or you get scared whenever they started to come up, or you'd just be getting Godzilla dreams. You know. That's repairable, sure. That's just ordinary ego psychology stuff, you know. Yeah. It's a harder problem when the anima, the animus themselves are different and don't do their job. That's a more difficult problem. We'll get into that when we get into the picture here. I did want to share this with you and the thing with the animals to give you a sense of the animus, because you can read about the anima. It seems to me that the animus is like animal life at its core, and out doing things and foraging and gathering, you know, like men. And the anima in a woman, in a man, is like plant life. So that when a man dreams of trees or plants, I usually think that that's a symbol of the anima. And when a woman dreams of trees or plants, that's a symbol of the self. When a man dreams of animals, that's a symbol of the self, like the fish. And when a woman dreams of animals, that's a symbol of the animus. It becomes really important if you can get in touch with like some of your main animals inside you. Like the Indians have this concept of the totem animal. We all have those, huh? If a woman can get in touch with her totem animal and have a sense of what that is, it might even be an animal that's offensive to you. It'd be really helpful to know that. I've known people who just, women who simply getting in touch with that changed their whole lives. Very useful thing to develop. That's the animal. Let's see. Okay, now I want to get into this diagram here that I made. I had hoped to have a blackboard, but what I'll do is just point. Have you all got one of these? You want it? Okay. This is a good diagram. I really like it, and I think it's worth the price of admission in and of itself. With a little explanation, I think it really summarizes a great deal of Jungian psychology. Let me see if I can clarify that. I need a pointer. Okay. First of all, you see this dark, heavy line I drew that separates the outer world from the inner world. And everything in this circle here, this is your psyche. And that's all in the inner world, because the psyche is an inner world phenomenon. I mean, I know theoretically that you have a psyche, but there's no way I can really test that out. You know, I just assume that because you're a person. But I can't really know that. Because only you know that, because that's in your psyche is completely in the inner world. I can't measure it or access it in any way. But the outer world stuff, you know, now I've got things here in the outer world, other people, stuff like microphones and books and stands. The body, your own body, is really viewed as part of the outer world for you from your psyche. I mean, you can lose a piece of it and still function, you know. So the body is part of the outer world. These are all the so-called real objects in the outer world. Then over here I have the inner world, the world of the archetypes. We've been talking a lot about the anima and the animus. But there's the father archetype, the old man archetype. The old man knows everything that can be known. The old woman archetype, she knows the rest. The mother archetype, the child, the self. I've kind of named some of the big archetypes. You asked before if they were finite. And I don't know, but these are the...
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.